Welcome to the Agile Book Club. You are your hosts, Justina and Paul.
Yeah, that's one we can look into, but I'd like to check in with the author first and see if they'd be willing to do an interview with us or have some kind of plan for if they say no. So.
Then we'll record the second podcast with, this author said no to us. Now we didn't start it. What we really didn't like about the book.
So the author refused to do an interview with us. So standing in for the author is this sock puppet. So, author, what do you have to say about people who say that you're standoffish and stuck up? I think that's absolutely true about me, Paul and Justina. That's why I refuse to talk to the press, or anybody, for that matter. Well, thank you, Mr. Sock Puppet Author.
Yep.
So. Shall we do this? Good morning.
Good morning, London.
And hello. So this is, folks, this is going to be a little bit different. Maybe not so different. This will be a little bit different. It's different for us because Justine and I are not in our studio. We're not in our closet in the Bobble Hill office. Justine and I are in London. We're recording this from her Airbnb flat because we came for Klaus Leopold. You'll remember Klaus Leopold. He was the first person that we interviewed on this podcast. And we came to take a flight levels workshop with Klaus Leopold based on the book that we reviewed, which was the very first book that we reviewed on this podcast. And it was fabulous.
Yes, it was fabulous. Actually, one of the things that I was missing in the book was how to actually implement the flight levels. And the workshop kind of gave me, and I think you, the answer. So thank you, Klaus.
Yes.
Well
yes.
done.
He's a lovely man to spend two days with. Strongly recommended if you get a chance to do it. So we're here in sunny London. And when I say sunny London, I mean in the last 3 days we were here, I saw the sun once.
Yes.
Which for London is pretty good. And
one of the things that you have to know, if you are going to travel to London, please take Paul because he stops the rain. He's the person with whom when you are walking on the street and it's like really, really heavy rain, it's just enough that he's outside and it stops. So, yeah, if you don't have a good umbrella, ask Paul to come with you.
Yeah, this is kind of a little secret of mine, is that I do have a superpower. It doesn't rain on me.
Yeah.
It happens everywhere. We were in Rome once. I was in Rome with my family, and there was this threatening torrential downpour. The sky was dark and black, and there was thunder everywhere, and the bus was late, and we were stuck on this very narrow street with high walls. We were plastered against the wall, just waiting for the rain to break over us. And the bus was late, and so we knew we were going to be drenched, and the bus pulled up, and the whole... I mean, I knew we weren't going to be drenched. My wife doesn't believe this. 20 years, and my wife still doesn't believe that it doesn't rain on me, even though she's seen it so many times. The bus pulls up, we step onto the bus, the moment the doors close behind us, the heavens just open up and deluge for the entire bus ride. Absolute deluge, just pounding rain. You can't see through the bus windows until we arrive at our destination about 7 or 8 minutes later. The doors open and the sun comes out just as I'm stepping out. This happens to me all the time. So yes, it's a superpower.
I confirm.
And now a third party, an independent third party has witnessed it. It doesn't rain on me.
Yes.
So now this has been a really exciting experience for us and a really pleasant experience for us because it's been a stressful few weeks. You folks don't know this, but Justina is doing her first solo agile coaching gig.
Mm-hmm.
And...
That's what you say. Well, that's what they think.
Not stressful for me. Yeah. I'm fine. But, I was talking to a friend of ours. I hope you don't mind. I was talking to a friend of ours about the coaching gig and that you were really nervous about it. And he recorded a little message for you. Do you want to hear it?
Oh, yes.
Hey, Larry Thomas, the soup Nazi from Seinfeld here. And I have a little message for you, Justina. So, Justina, Paul tells me that you're having a rough time with your first consulting gig.
Yeah.
And he wanted to remind you that you are as tough as I am. Well, then, in that case, it should go pretty good. And, you will also be collecting plenty of great stories for your podcast, The Agile Book Club. So, just go out there and tell them, no soup for you. Or maybe don't tell them that if it doesn't get you the job. Have fun.
No soup for you.
No kanban for you. No kanban for you. Wasn't that nice of him?
Oh, yeah.
Now, listeners, I don't know if you know this, because I know most of you aren't celebrities. Most people, it's basic statistics. It's just math. Most of you aren't celebrities. You can't be, and it's not fair, but that's just the way it is. You can't be celebrities, because if you were all celebrities, then what would a celebrity be? Mm-hmm. Right? Celebrities have to be different from normal people. And I don't know if you know this, but we've only been podcasting for, what, 6 episodes now or so?
Yes.
But it does kind of launch you into lofty heights. So obviously, folks like the Soup Nazi, Larry David from Seinfeld, is now a friend of ours, as is Arnold Schwarzenegger and Renee Zellweger. We started podcasting, and the invitation to Hollywood came a little late. It took a couple of weeks, but
it came to Hamilton.
Mm-hmm. So we are now officially celebrities, and things like this just happen to us.
Yeah.
Famous actors just reach out and give us a pat on the back from time to time, invite us to parties. I don't recommend going into podcasting if you're not ready for the lifestyle, because I'm telling you, it's crazy.
Yeah.
It's the privacy I miss the most about podcasting. The constant scrutiny of my life, you know?
Now the number of people that will ask you to travel with them to make the rain stop, to don't destroy their honeymoons and all this.
I think we've got a new line of business for Bobble Hill.
Yeah. Take Paul with you.
So let's shall we get to
yes.
The matter of it?
Yes.
To the matter, into the depth, get to the marrow. We read a book.
Mm-hmm.
We read the book we said we were going to read. By an old friend of ours, a fellow we've known for a long time. He's written 2 other books before, both very good. And so we were really excited when Mike Burroughs came out with a new book, From Right to Left.
August 15, I guess, 2019, the date that he published.
You better remember my birthday.
Okay.
If you remember dates like that, you'd better remember my birthday. So, yes, recently published by Mike Burroughs, From Right to Left. A book for digital leaders, and that's what we're going to be talking about in this episode. So let's kick it off with an elevator pitch. Can you give us your elevator pitch for this book, Justina?
Yes. Actually, I recommend to everyone to read the full title of the book, because if you just read Right to Left, you might be a little bit disappointing with the book, especially if you're Agile coach or Scrum master, the person who is really in the field. But if you read the subtitle, that this is a guide for the digital leaders, you get the whole idea of the book, that this is the guide. The point of the book is not to dig into all frameworks and tools. It's rather to give you the overview of what you might find, what you might come across, and where to look for more answers. So in that case, I think that this is a very, very useful book for all the people that are overwhelmed with the amount of the information that is out there, and they have no idea what is Scrum, what is Kanban, what is service thinking, what is design thinking, all of those things that we constantly hear, and we might think that they are just buzzwords. It's a nicely collected group of definitions that we can come across in digital and software development world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think I had a very similar impression. I'd couch it a little bit differently. So yes, if I was in an elevator, especially if it was an elevator in a large building, my elevator pitches are a little long-winded, I know. Imagine in an elevator in a large building. We're going up to the 120th floor. If I was in the elevator with a friend of mine, with a fellow Agile coach, for example, I would probably tell them that there is you should definitely read parts of this book. No question. I think my recommendation to an agile coach would be to read the first chapter so you understand what he's talking about and his idea of applying right to left thinking. And then for goodness sake, skim or skip over the next two chapters, because they are just a survey of all the tools that we're very familiar with. And it's a very shallow survey. So it's just enough information that if you know nothing about it, you might have some insights into whether or not it might be useful to you or not. But if you know something about it, you'll either be confused, or if you know a lot about it, if it's your favorite tool or your favorite methodology or what have you, you'll probably be angered by how shallow the treatment is. So the next two chapters are just a survey of lots and lots of tools in the digital world. But the last two chapters, I think, are fabulous reading for anyone, whether a digital leader, a team lead, an agile coach, what have you, because in those last two chapters, Mike does something very similar to what he did in his last book, Agenda Shift. He lays out some very nice new and original frameworks for meetings and facilitation and organization that are his own ideas and novel and rich in description and easy to implement and useful. And so I think this book is absolutely worth it, even if only for the last two chapters alone.
But even for the new people in the field, like for Scrum Masters who just got their first job, if they need like the guide of what is there still to learn, to dig into, I think that may also be a good place to start.
But the important thing here is that this book is specifically written for digital leaders.
Yes.
And if I had to be harsh about it, I would say for digital leaders who have found themselves uncomfortably in that position, because I know in my consulting work and in my career, I've come across two kinds of digital leaders. I don't want to be unfair to anybody, but listeners, I'm going to tell you something that's going to. You're listening to the Agile Book Club podcast, and so you're probably already deep, deep in the Agile world. And something that we often forget inside of our Agile bubble is that as big as the Agile bubble has become, it's still a bubble, and the vast, vast, vast majority of software in the world is not made using any kind of a process that could be described as Agile. Most of the successful software that we use is developed using waterfall approaches. And so there are a lot of people who are extremely proficient at IT management, but who have had no exposure or very limited exposure to any of the tools, techniques, thought patterns that we take for granted. So if you are in a position of leading a digital team and you are either skeptical or curious about what the agile world, the agile community has to offer, and you've heard all of the terms, you've heard Agile and XP and Scrum and Kanban and Safe and Less and what have you, and you want to just get an overview of all of these various ideas and tools that are available to you as a starting point, then this is the book that was written for you, and you will get a lot of value from it. Nothing in this book, none of the descriptions of any of these processes or technologies or tools will be sufficient. But as a survey of the current state of the agile world, I think it's excellent. And he does a particularly good job, I think, of describing the use cases for SAFe. I think he does a very nice job of summarizing what SAFe is, when it's useful, and when it's not. And this is something that I know is a SAFe is emerging as the de facto standard for large-scale digital transformations. And so for digital leaders in corporations, it's becoming essential to have, to at least have an opinion on SAFE. And this is a very good place to start in forming an opinion. Although I'm reminded, I'm reminded of a play. What was the play? I saw a play when I was in Chicago a few months ago. It was a one-man play, and there was one line from it that just stuck out for me. It was a play about a theater critic, a very cynical theater critic. And the line that I cannot forget because it was just so clever was, I didn't form opinions, I just had them. And I think that resonates because you see that a lot. You mm-hmm. see that a lot every place. Almost all of us have, if I throw out something in our community, like Scrum, what do you think? There are plenty of people who have an opinion. Especially if I throw out something like SAFE. Mm-hmm. Anything that's new or controversial, the number of people who have an opinion is much larger than the number of people who have any depth of experience. And so if you're trying to form an opinion, this book won't help you do it, but it's a good starting point.
So was it your first takeaway or extended elevator pitch?
I ramble. That was an extended elevator pitch. Let's move on. Just keep me moving forward. Okay. What's your first takeaway?
So I really enjoyed the first part of the chapter when he explains the metaphor from right to left. And he actually gives a good point that if you want to present in organization what Agile is about, you don't start with saying there are ceremonies, those are the values, those are the new roles that you have to implement. You can just start from the outcomes that will come from implementing Agile and valuing it, like how it will benefit your business, how it will benefit your team members, the whole organization. It's so simple what he wrote, but on the other hand, I think it's so powerful because especially for everyone who is consultant and coach, when they ask you, what will you do? Sometimes you start with, oh, there will be this workshop, I will work with this team, do this and that, and we'll implement stand-up, retrospectives, or maybe grooming. Like, you give so much information that those people do not understand. You should start from the outcomes. And actually, I wish I read this earlier, that I went into the first serious consulting gig, because I think that would help me a little bit to structure of what we want to achieve. Without taking 100% guarantee that everyone knows what is Agile, Kanban, Scrum, SAFE stuff.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And the book is titled Right to Left. That is really the core idea in the book. And one of the things that he does in that chapter that I rather like is he offers both a left to right and a right to left definition of mm-hmm. Scrum. I think of Kanban as well. And indeed, when we're in the mix, when we're actually doing the work, and you ask us what Scrum is, then we talk about what we do.
Yes.
Not why we do it. Mm-hmm. And we do it for a right-to-left reason. Yeah. The other observation that he made on the same note, which I rather liked, is that when you look at your process from right-to-left, and you think about your process from right-to-left, and folks, if you're listening, Mike, we haven't really defined this very well. So usually, you've got, if you're using an Agile process, you have some sort of a visualization. It might be digital, it might be on a whiteboard, some sort of a visualization of the knowledge work. And it could be a detailed visualization that shows every single step in the process, like a detailed Kanban board, a huge end-to-end Kanban board. Or it might be something more simple. I've worked with Scrum teams that only had three or four columns, you know, like backlog, development, testing, done. But in any case, there's usually some kind of a visualization on a board, and there are columns, and on the left-hand side, you've got the work that hasn't been started yet, and on the right-hand side, you've got the work that is done. And so left to right description of the process is, first we organize the backlog, then we prioritize the backlog and decide what to do next, then we develop it, then we test it, then we deploy it, and then the customers have it, and we get feedback from them. A right to left is inverting the whole thing, which is, so what is it that you're doing with Scrum? Well, we're delivering batches of value to customers on a regular basis. How do you do that? Well, we do that by validating that our assumptions were correct, by building software and seeing what they think of it. Well, how do you do that? Well, we actually develop the software. Well, where does that come from? Well, it comes from a backlog. And so right to left thinking is looking at your process from the outcomes of the process rather than from the ceremonies and the work that you do to get started. And what I liked about it is not only does it emphasize the customer, it's really customer-centric and customer-first thinking, but it de-emphasizes the plan. And I think, I don't think that Mike states that explicitly in the book, but it's very easy with the amount of work that we put in to collecting a pool of options and to building a backlog or even a more detailed rollout plan with milestones and such, we can get very attached to the plan because we invest a lot of our effort into it and we want the world to see it. And that bias for the plan can interfere with delighting customers. Mm-hmm. We start trying to delight ourselves.
Yes.
So the customer-first approach is more than just a customer-first approach. It's also distracting attention, taking attention and energy away from a plan that isn't tested or validated yet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I think like the beginning of the book just shows you how much you can achieve by just changing your perspective where you look, even at your board. Where do you start?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. What else, Paul, for you?
I had a few. I had one kind of overarching observation and that I like. And I think perhaps it's because so many of the books that we read as coaches are aimed at us. And this book is specifically aimed at digital leaders. But I really like how this book places scaling agile culture squarely on the shoulders of digital leaders. I think we've seen so many failed transformations that start bottom up and end up creating little islands of agile, little pockets of agile in an organization at the bottom where you have agile teams but not agile leadership. And the responsibility for bringing agility into the organization is placed on the shoulders of coaches who are mostly working at the team level. And this book, throughout, as a common thread, makes a very clear case that doing that will give you agile teams. But if what you want is an agile organization, that's not something that an external coach can do for you. It's you, your responsibility to make that happen, to make that culture happen. And he gives a lot of tools. He provides a lot of tools and ideas for how to go about doing that. I think his overview of servant leadership, for example, is excellent, and his descriptions of alternate ways to do things like service delivery reviews and strategy reviews from an outside-in perspective are worth the price of the book in and of themselves.
Actually, you're super right, because that's my second takeaway. I find it extremely useful what he's done with service delivery review and service strategy review, both of them with the whole perspective, with tips, with showing how beneficial for the business is bringing the perspective of the client, product, platform, team, and organization. I really like how he outlined how each of those perspectives can benefit with bringing the big picture, the holistic view of your organization, and what can you do? Because I've seen many people talking about poorly designed strategy or no service delivery review and all the pain that it brought into their organization. And I really see a value in both of them. And if someone never took a part in meeting like that, or is just about to face the challenge to design this kind of the meeting, I highly recommend to go to chapter 5 and read how to do it, to don't forget, for example, about the user perspective, because it's extremely needed, to don't forget about those people who work in support and help desk, because they are the closest to the client. They can tell you so much what those people need. So maybe instead of investing a lot of money in the research, you can just read and listen to what your actual customers are complaining and need right now.
Mm-hmm. And it was in that section that he introduced the rule of three, which in and of itself was one of my takeaways. So it's a nice segue. And I can't say it better than he can. So I'm just going to share what he wrote.
Yes.
The rule of three is this. Design your strategy and governance meetings so that they invite the active participation of at least three levels of seniority. Include representatives from a range of different disciplines who have skin in the game and are respected for their direct knowledge of the situation. So there's really three things in there. The first one, which in and of itself I think is very powerful, is the idea that in a strategy meeting or in a service delivery meeting, you should have at least three levels of the hierarchy. There should be somebody more senior. There should be somebody who's closer to the coalface doing the work. There should be middle management represented. And that in itself is quite powerful, because what I see so often in service delivery reviews is they happen between maybe one of the more senior people on the team, like a lead developer or something will be on it. Usually somebody who's in a project management or agile coach role will be on it, and they'll be a representative of the client in that meeting. But the outcomes of that meeting have to be distilled up and down. And it's difficult in both directions when the people who have to understand what comes out of the service delivery review don't actually participate in it and don't hear it firsthand. And so they have all of their various biases filtering everything that they hear as the outcomes of that meeting. And the same with the people who are actually doing the work, who don't attend the meeting. They hear the outcomes of the meeting, but they filter it through their own perspectives and biases. Mm-hmm. And so nobody actually hears the voice of the customer. But the other two items, I think, are equally important. And that is, those people, those three levels of seniority that are represented should also be people who are participating actively and are known to be involved and informed. They're not just there to supervise. They're not just there to listen in. It's not a reporting meeting. It's not where a senior person comes in just to check and make sure that the customer sounds happy. This should be a person who can actively participate in the conversation because they are involved. And that can be enormously powerful.
Mm. But I think in most of the cases when I heard from people who are actually a part of those kind of the meetings, they were complaining that this is like finger pointing, or like this is the presentation of like slide PowerPoint presentation with a lot of charts that doesn't mean anything because we don't even trust them. We don't know who even made them. And that there's not a lot of big value in there for the future, I would say, business. Yeah.
And I think that's where the details that Mike goes into in this book about how that meeting should be arranged and who should share what and in what order information should be shared and what sorts of data should be brought to that meeting is extremely useful. I'm not going to go through all of it on this podcast. Read the book. I think you should read the book. If you're facilitating service delivery reviews, or more importantly, if you're not facilitating service delivery reviews, because there are none, then that's definitely worth reading. I think it'll be inspiring and very helpful to you.
Or if you want to impress your bosses and you hear that your organization has very poor service delivery review, read the book, go there and suggest what they could do better. 10 points for you. As simple as that. Anything else, Paul?
There was one other thing that jumped out at me, which I appreciated. And I think it's just because not only is it close to my heart, but it also resonates because of the last book that we read, and it's something that's been coming up more and more. Something I've been very aware of lately is, because I've also been having conversations with colleagues who are struggling with metrics and with the proper utilization of metrics inside of their organizations. And it is so problematic that I really appreciated the way that Mike included in this book, which is that metrics should be collected and shared by a self-organizing team to support their own work. And there's a lot in there. There's a whole lot in there. Because metrics should be collected by the team. They should be shared by the team. And they should support the team. What typically happens if there are metrics is metrics are collected automatically by a tool or by some manager. And not by the team, but by some manager or by some tool. Not for the team, for some manager, or just as a vanity metric. And it should be in order to support their own work, specifically not as a system of reward or supervision. And that last bit, I think, is particularly striking. In organizations that gather metrics, in the vast majority of the organizations I've seen that actually collect and monitor metrics, especially flow metrics, it seems healthy to look for positive trends. So I see these metrics being distilled up through layers of management. You can see how there's been a 3% improvement in our average lead time over the course of the last quarter, yada, yada. What's happening there is that they're being used as a supervisory metric. You've got people who are tracking these metrics and following these metrics to see how their delivery teams are delivering without necessarily having skin in the game, without knowing what's going on the ground, without being involved in the process. They want these metrics just as a sort of trailing indicator of where there are problems, where they should go in and apply their authority or their power. So they're looking for red flags. They're looking for where the weak, where the struggling parts of their organization are. Mm-hmm. And the real value in flow metrics isn't in using them as a supervisory tool for senior management. Fundamentally, metrics should be gathered by the team, for the team, and used by the team in order for the team to improve. And any other use of such metrics is troubling.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and I think especially when someone is gathering cycle times and then they don't look at the flow efficiency of what they have and they try to shorten the cycle time, but by making people working faster instead of like looking at the time when the work is actively neglected, when no one is working because of the blocker or the dependency. So instead of like looking at this and find a way to help teams overcome that, to reduce that and to make them unleash their full potential, they just try to make them work faster, which doesn't bring any results.
So managers and senior leadership who don't spend time with the teams and are just watching what's happening based on metrics that are coming their way, they can't really understand the problem, and they have a pretty limited toolkit for addressing it. In the organizations that I've seen, typically they either want to create incentives, so if you deliver on time, pizza party for everyone or whatever, any kind of incentive, or create some sort of pressure, like we're going to work through the weekend or we're going to You've got to find a way to solve this problem, or this going down visiting the team and saying, this is very important and I don't know how you're going to do it, but this is your responsibility to find a way to, just putting the pressure on them. Or they're the helpful kind and they just say, send your blockers my way and I will just escalate. And at least that last one can be somewhat helpful, but it's just shifting burdens within the organization and it's not improving the organizational agility. It's not leadership, it's firefighting by senior management. And so yes, metrics should be collected by the team and used by the team for the team. Stop. Period.
Yes.
Senior leadership should have reporting mechanisms in place so the team can ask for help when they need it, mm-hmm. rather than these passive mechanisms that are designed to just give a very shallow view into what's happening without any context.
And that are designed actually to make people afraid of metrics and hiding things and hiding problems like under the carpet. Yes, I think that you got the point, Paul.
Mm-hmm.
But
Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. It's not so bad. So actually, I think it's connected with my last takeaway, which is the definition of servant leader, that he mentioned that there are two components of that role. The first one is people positive, because it's mostly focused on trying to help other people to unleash their potential, giving them everything that they need in order to succeed. And I've seen that in this organization that I am right now. There is Agile Coach and she's doing a fabulous job. I have no idea how she is capable of doing it so smoothly, maybe because she's there for so many years. But for the last 2 weeks, I was just admiring her work, how quickly she solves those little problems that other people are just mentioning, not even complaining. Like her way of working, it's like problem solving now. There's obstacle, and this is how we are going to overcome, and we do it now. We don't plan it, we don't even put it in the wiki. Okay, we can put it in the wiki, but we come back there to solve it. It's not only about complaining. Give me your pain, I will try to make it away as much as I can. Oh, beautiful rhyme, I'm proud. And then the second part of that role, it's actually the complexity that you are aware that what you do with a team serves the whole organization, that by helping them, you help the organization to be healthy and to grow. So that was something very useful, especially for Scrum Masters who call themselves that they are servant leaders. But sometimes they just use it as the opportunity to say, this is not my responsibility, it's team responsibility, I'm just in between those two. And I think if they would understand the role, they would know that, okay, it's not your responsibility, but your responsibility is to create environment that can help those people to solve those problems.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like that. I thought his handling of servant leadership, the topic of servant leadership, was excellent and inspiring.
Thank you, Mike.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mike. How about favorite quotes?
Yes, okay. I actually have two. One doesn't come from the book, but it comes from the talk that was about the book that Mike recorded on one of the conference. But I think it's really worth to mention. It's definition of done. It's when someone's need was met. Like, this is the essence for me of working based on outcomes. When the user's needs was met, it means that you are done. So that was from one of the conference talk that was titled From Right to Left. And from the book, I have one. Don't start with what you can't finish. As simple as that.
Your good rule of thumb generally.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
You know, I was thinking about that definition of done, and I think I might amend it to say when a customer's need is, when someone's need is adequately met.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Because we, in so many cases, I'm not a believer in the totally satisfied customer, the enthusiastic customer. That's wonderful, I suppose. But I had a business, I had a marketing professor back in business school who used to use the expression the barely satisfied customer, which I also don't buy into, but I think it's a good idea. And his reasoning was that total customer satisfaction or creating ecstatic customers is an illustration of waste. The goal of the business is to gain and retain customers. And anything that you do above and beyond what you need to do to retain a customer is putting resources into something that's not bringing business value. But on the flip side, what we so often do by not validating our ideas is we take a customer problem, we implement a solution, the solution partially solves the problem, and we call it done. Yeah. And so if we're not validating that the problem is adequately solved, that the customer, that we really understood the problem, then what we end up with is a whole product that is just a suite of half-baked solutions.
Yes.
That everything works, but only barely. Mm-hmm. And that's very common.
Yeah, I think that you got that, yeah.
So I had a few as well. One that I really liked is, continuous improvement is no substitute for strategy.
Oh, yes, that's perfect.
He explains it nicely. To extend the quotation, it's not enough to solve problems. They have to be the right problems. Mm-hmm. And indeed, in so many organizations and in so many digital departments, the goal is continuous improvement. And there seems to be this idea that if everyone is improving continuously, you will automatically achieve or approach a state of perfection. That everything, but if you're improving the wrong things, if you're improving your time to market at the cost of quality, for example, or improving things that don't actually matter in the end, then you're not you're not adequately using the time and tools available to you. And you might achieve some perfect destination, but it's not the destination your customer wants you to be at.
Yeah, but very often I think it's also kind of excuse. Mm-hmm. It's not perfect because it's continuously improved. Oh, it's MVP, and this is just excuse. You cannot, yeah, you have to keep the quality in place as well.
Define the goal, make sure that you have a strategic purpose for that goal, and then execute the improvements that are going to get you to that goal the fastest. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Don't give lazy answers. Yeah.
Continuous improvement is no substitute for strategy.
Yes.
Again, this is a book written for digital leaders.
Yes.
And if you're just looking at metrics and your mantra is, let's keep getting those cycle times down, let's keep getting those cycle times down, that is not a strategy. That's not a digital strategy. You said you had two.
Yes, I have one more. That most failures are failures of communication.
Oh, yes.
That I think so often we are focused on work in front of our desks and work and be busy and be busy. And we have we are against meetings. We don't see value in them, but we don't see the value in them because we already have some resistance. If on those meetings we would focus on the workflow, maybe our life would be just easier. Or if we would focus on how this particular epic is connected with the strategy that we are working on, or how can we benefit out of it, what is the outcome. If we would just have the right conversations, I think that will reduce a lot of failures.
And that's really so much of what these frameworks are designed to provide, is to try to encourage the right people to have the right conversation at the right time.
Yes. Easy.
Easy peasy.
Easy peasy.
I've got one more that I really liked.
Okay.
This quotation comes from after Mike's survey of several different tools and frameworks. And he wrote, if you come to the realization that one of these frameworks, like Scrum or Kanban, has become the lens by which you view the others, experiment with taking the opposite perspective and notice how your understanding changes. Yeah, nice. Think about that one. Mm-hmm. This is what happens when Scrum people look at Kanban from a Scrum lens, and Kanban people look at Scrum from a Kanban lens, and when any scaling approach looks at any other scaling approach, anytime you define yourself based on your tools or based on your frameworks, it colors your thinking, it colors your perspective of everything else. And this is one of the things that I love about being a human. The humans dream, and we have rich, rich imaginations. one of the things that allows us to work together is our capacity for empathy. A human being can put themselves mentally into a different point of view, another person's point of view, with ridiculously little effort. Mm-hmm. And it's the reason that we're able to work together and collaborate and build clans and tribes and villages and cities and actually create wonderful things, is because we're able to get into each other's head and see each other's points of view and empathize and find common ground. And it's such a powerful tool. Nancy Klein talks about this when she talks about incisive questions. So, for example, in Nancy Klein's book, Time to Think, she says that when she's talking to somebody and they're trying to solve a problem and they get stuck by something in their own head, when someone gets stuck by something that's only in their own head, like for example, you know, we've got these problems, but there's nothing I can do about it because I'm just an intern, she'll ask what she calls an incisive question, which is a question that incises, that cuts through the barrier, like, well, what if they promoted you to CEO tomorrow? What would you do? And an intern can easily imagine herself as CEO just by trying. Well, if I was the CEO, I would reorganize this department this way. And that might be a really useful idea, which she was incapable of having while she was thinking from the mindset of an intern. But the moment she adopted the mindset of a CEO, she could come to this conclusion. And by the same token, you can go through your whole career as that Scrum guy, analyzing everything from a Scrum point of view. But all it takes is a question like the one that Mike poses here, which is, if you weren't a Scrum guy, if you were a Kanban guy, what would you think of this? Mm-hmm. And you could just shift your mindset and say, well, Kanban thinks these things are important and it solves problems in this way. And I can see where, from that point of view, I might see some certain shortcomings in my favorite framework. Maybe there is something to offer from that point of view. So I really enjoyed that quotation.
Yeah, that's powerful. Powerful shift of your thinking. Yeah. I might use that. Okay, Paul, so what should we read for the next month?
You know, I don't have a list this time, but I do recall that there's one book. Every single time we've had this conversation for the last few months, there's one book that's come up each time. And we typically have chosen a different book because someone we know recently published a book. Mm-hmm. And we have a bias for recent books.
Yes.
But I think this podcast can do it. There's so many great books out there, and there are so many people out there. What is the saying? Every day there's someone born who's never seen the Flintstones. And so if you pick the single most popular agile book, I don't know what it is. Call it the original Scrum book, or call it Kent Beck's White Book, or whatever it is. Pick the most popular book in the Scrum world or in the Agile world, and most Agile coaches haven't read it. Mm-hmm. So I think there is value in going back and looking at some of these books that have made a real impact, and sharing them both to encourage people who haven't read them yet, and as a pleasant refresher for people who did read and love them. So the book that keeps coming up is Rolling Rocks Downhill by Clark Ching. And one of the reasons why I want to read it is I love the subtitle. The full title of this book is Rolling Rocks Downhill, the Agile Business Novel That Never Mentions Agile.
Yes. I think that that's enough to say about this book. I read it 2 years ago when I was on holidays in Portugal. I enjoyed it very, very much, and I would love to read it again.
All right.
Yes, let's make the next Agile Book Club podcast about the book that we both simply love.
So thank you, everyone. This has been an interesting one for us to record because, for one thing, we're sitting in an unfamiliar apartment in London. For another, there's construction going on outside, and I hope you don't hear too much of that. I'm going to do my best to edit as much of that out as I can. And for another, we were at Hamilton last night, and so I don't think either of us got a whole lot of sleep. If you haven't seen it yet, oh my goodness gracious.
Yes, see it.
Hamilton is fabulous. Now,
I wish I could sing. I would sing for you, but I really can't, so I'm not going.
No, no, hear it for yourself. Hear it for yourself. I could sing you the whole score right now.
Give it something. Give it something to say sorry to the audience. Like, they have to have something that they didn't have in the previous episodes.
All right, I'm going to tell you right now, if you ever hear me sing on this podcast, that is the episode that breaks the Agile Book Club. That's not going to happen. Okay. But I hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Agile Book Club podcast. We're going to be interviewing Mike Burrows for our next episode, so we can get his perspectives and his takes and learn a bit about his thinking when he was writing this book and the kind of feedback that he's gotten on it and what he thinks are the most important parts of it. So please join us in 2 weeks for the next Agile Book Club, and thank you so much for listening.
Thank you so much.